Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie reading the Big Bend Sentinel on August 27th. Facing pandemic and postal cuts, county officials prepare for hectic election. By Abby Perot and Steve Paulson. Tri-County, the United States Postal Service, and concerns about restructuring and cuts at the agency has been in the news a lot lately. After a chronic budget issues exacerbated by the coronavirus, the Postal Service in April warned that it was facing insolvency. At press time, it's unclear how or whether changes at USPS have affected local residents. USPS did not answer questions about overtime hours and mail volume in Tri-County zip codes. And while the Big Bend Sentinel has filed records requests seeking this information, we have not received any records yet. USPS workers in the region also declined to comment for the story, citing USPS policy. But in interviews with the Big Bend Sentinel, local election officials throughout the region outlined how they were preparing for the challenges of this year's election, including a surge in requests for mail-in ballots. Despite the upheavals, local officials say they're confident that mail-in and absentee ballots won't be lost in the shuffle. And for added peace of mind, they also stress that this year, locals are welcome to submit mail-in ballots in person. Recent changes with the Postal Service have worried many Americans, particularly in rural areas where the post office serves as a lifeline for everything, from receiving medications to sending orders out from small businesses. In Texas, state officials have fought in court to limit vote-by-mail to only older and disabled voters. Since rural areas also skew older than urban ones, postal concerns matter, especially in the Big Bend. Election officials in the tri-counties all said they were seeing a higher demand for mail-in ballots this year compared to previous elections. Nora Nussbaum, the elections administrator for Brewster County, has already received nearly 150 more mail-in ballot requests for the general election than she did for the primary, and her office is still months away from the October 23rd deadline to request a mail-in ballot. The very first year I was in here, we had under 300 mail-in requests, Nussbaum said this week. Right now, we have a little over 400. She stressed that requests have to be received by October 23rd, the deadline, not just postmarked by that date. Requests can be dropped off too, she said. To get a mail-in ballot, voters must be registered to vote, with the registration deadline on October 5th this year. In May, President Donald Trump appointed Louis DeJoy as Postmaster General. DeJoy, a polarizing figure with no prior post office experience, has extensive investments in some of USPS's top competitors, including the logistics company XPO, and has been a donor to President Trump's campaigns. On August 7th, DeJoy modified the organizational structure of the USPS in an effort to operate in a more efficient and effective manner, a press release announced. The move pushed out a handful of longtime USPS leaders out, reassigning or replacing 23 executives. Concerns escalated among Congress and U.S. residents as DeJoy's USPS reportedly cut back on overtime hours, starting removing mailboxes throughout the country and followed orders to dismantle mail sorting machines in major mail hubs. I am so concerned about the delays, said Jeannie Mitchell, a member of the regional nonpartisan Tri-County Voter Promoters. Anecdotally, Mitchell said she has already noticed it in mail delivery that I get, so I would encourage people to get those applications in as soon as possible. Make their plans now as if they are going to vote by mail or vote in person, or do it just as quickly as possible, she said. Don't wait till the last minute. Senator John Cornyn denied any issues at the government agency, calling it a non-scandal in a Washington Post op-ed and a conspiracy theory in a TV interview this week. But another Republican representing the Tri-County seemed to disagree. As the U.S. House of Representatives called a special reconvening this summer to address post office concerns, the Tri-County's Congressman Representative Will Hurd voted alongside many Democrats to authorize $25 billion to help the USPS handle the pandemic and upcoming election. USPS provides prescriptions, absentee ballots, cleaning products, birthday cards, a method to pay bills, and so much more to the American people, and they're doing this throughout the pandemic, said Hurd. America's Postal Service is essential, and like always, I will continue to support them. Notably, he also broke from the party line by calling for nationwide mail-in voting for all. We should be making it easier to vote rather than putting up barriers, the statement added. Exercising our civic duty in unprecedented times requires unprecedented measures. The solution is for every state to allow voters to request a mail-in ballot due to COVID-19 health risks, not haphazardly mailing out ballots. Testifying before Congress this week, DeJoy said that he'd pause any further changes to public postal services, but not roll back the existing ones, until after the November election. But some experts feared the damage was already done, imperiling the federal government's most popular program. 91% of Americans view the USPS favorably. A Pew poll from April found once again beating out every other federal agency. Despite an increase in expected mail-in ballots, officials in both Presidio and Jeff Davis counties said they were already preparing for the election and were confident they could handle it. I'm not concerned, said Florcita Zubia, a deputy county clerk in Presidio County, who has 4 years helped out with many county elections. She acknowledged that there would be challenges, from more traffic to the fact that the county officials this year would also be helping with Marfa's city elections. But said sometimes the news can overemphasize what's actually happening, and in the case of Presidio County, at least, she didn't think there was any cause to be sounding alarms. Zubia encouraged people to call the county if they had any questions and urged residents to vote, whether via mail or in person. The elections office can be reached at 432-729-4081. The way we speak out is through our vote, Zubia added. We have voting machines available, and they're very user-friendly. Carol Truax, the deputy county district clerk in Jeff Davis County, said much the same. While she said Jeff Davis County was also seeing an increase in mail-in ballots, she said adjustments were being made at the state and local levels to cope with any challenges. This year, for example, people can drop off mail-in ballots at the clerk's office, not just on election day, but at any point during early voting. Truax also addressed another concern making the rounds, that people might vote by mail and never know if their ballot was actually counted. Absentee voters can contact the clerk's office at any time to make sure their vote ballot was received, Truax said. And in the case of a ballot that was received but also rejected, she said residents would be contacted by elections officials. Our post office does a really great job, she added. They're very, very good. Still, with added coronavirus precautions this year, she acknowledged that in-person voting this year may take a little longer. Outside of county offices, concerns about the integrity of the Postal Service broke down mostly along party lines. Dan Dunlap, the Republican Party chairperson for Presidio County, said he had no concerns about USPS's ability to handle mail-in ballots. Clark Childers, the Democratic Party chairperson, said that while he was concerned about some of the issues at USPS, he didn't want to feed into the distrust of the USPS and had great faith in our local elections. I encourage everyone to vote in the way they feel most confident, he said. The most important thing is to simply vote. Still, he added that he wished he had more faith in the capabilities of our Postmaster General and that he hoped people will contact their elected officials and throw their support behind USPS, an agency that, he added, employed more than 7 million people overall, including more than 97,000 veterans. And while the post office may not always make money, Childers pointed out that plenty of other government services, including the military, also work that way. The USPS has unique challenges working against it. In 2006, Congress required the USPS to pay upfront for the next 75 years' worth of pensions, an unusual requirement that critics say makes it virtually impossible for the post office to turn a profit. If all the other counties are getting mail-in ballots like I am, the post office is going to be very busy, Nussbaum said. The Brewster County elections official was wary of advising voters how quickly they should return mail-in ballots, though afraid she might say it's a couple of days and then the post office doesn't get it in time. Brewster residents can submit their ballots directly to Nussbaum in person anytime after receiving them in the mail. For Brewster County residents concerned about voting logistics, Nussbaum urged voters to contact her directly at 432-837-6230. In a short social media post this week, the Postal Service, without providing further details, sent a message to mail-in voters. If you plan to vote by mail, the post read, plan ahead. Marfa Journalist makes appearance on new Netflix series by Stephen Paulson. United States. A new Netflix series exploring the wellness industry debuted this month, and one prominent local writer makes an appearance. The series, titled Unwell, looks at some of the latest health trends that modern Americans are using to treat what ails them. From fasting and ayahuasca to bee sting therapy. The first episode looks at essential oils, chemicals that have long been used for applications like perfumes, but which in recent years have taken on a new life for use in alternative health treatments. It's a topic that Rachel Monroe, a freelance journalist based in Marfa, knows well. In 2017, she wrote a long-form story on the products for The New Yorker, questioning whether their appeal came down to medicine or marketing. Monroe served as a paid consultant for the episode, helping connect the producers to sources and otherwise offering expertise. She also makes a couple cameos where she talks about her reporting and offers context on some of the big players in the industry, including Donald Gray Young, an enigmatic and polarizing figure who ran one of the largest essential oil companies until his death in 2018. Essential oils are a contentious subject. On one hand, a couple limited studies have shown the effectiveness of some oils, including the ability of lavender oil to treat anxiety. Countless Americans swear by them as tools for relaxation and to improve well-being. On the other hand, some essential oil boosters have gone much further, advertising the products as, for example, a cure for cancer. And the business behind essential oils does little to tamp down the controversy. Just two companies, doTERRA and Young Living, dominate the essential oils market. And both are multi-level marketing companies, a controversial business model in which salespeople earn based not just on products they sell, but on the people they recruit to join the company. In an interview on Tuesday, Monroe said she got curious about essential oils around 2015 when she started noticing them everywhere. More intriguing still, the products seem to have a broad-based appeal across all kinds of disparate subcultures. The interest in the oils crossed demographic lines, reaching people you wouldn't think would necessarily share the same interests, Monroe said. Those included some not-so-surprising groups, like hippies and my wellness yoga studio friends, Monroe said. On the other hand, there was also a strong Christian component to it and kind of overlaps with the anti-vaccine world. Assessing the validity of people's personal wellness rituals can be like walking into a minefield. And in both Monroe's original story and in the Netflix series, the reader is left to reach their own conclusions about whether essential oil advocates are right or wrong. I'm not a science journalist, Monroe said in her interview. I'm not qualified to tell anybody what's real or fake. And when it comes to science behind essential oils, she stresses, there is some research. It's not all made up. Still, aspects of the essential oil world did set off alarm bells for Monroe. For one thing, while she thinks many people are turned off by mainstream healthcare and the pharmaceutical industry for very understandable reasons, she also thinks that out of the mainstream health solutions, almost by design, offer an opening for charlatans and hucksters. Though she stresses that she doesn't want to paint with a hugely broad brush. Then there's the fact that many essential oils are sold through multi-level marketing companies. That's the thing that I feel on firmer ground critiquing, she said. What I feel comfortable saying is, I feel very skeptical of MLM or network marketing as a form of business, she adds. After all, multi-level marketing companies are often characterized by overpromises and talk about miraculous solutions, and even people in that structure fall prey to some of its incentives. For Monroe, who typically sticks to the written word, consulting on a TV show was an interesting experience. She recalled how she was interviewed in a random apartment in Williamsburg, a set she thinks was meant to give the illusion that it was her home. And when producers first called to discuss the project, she started eagerly talking about the subject she loves, only to stop herself once she realized she was giving away insights to a for-profit venture for free. Her advice to the writers who find themselves in that position, it's good to stand up for yourself and make sure you understand who is asking you for what. So where does Monroe personally stand on essential oils? I don't really use them for medicinal purposes, she said. I've never ingested them, and I never would ingest them. Still, she adds, some of them definitely smell good. She sometimes uses an essential oil diffuser as an air freshener, and I like to make my own cleaning supplies. But overall, she says, her interest in the products is more the aroma than the aromatherapy.
Hello, this is Sonia reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, August 27, 2020. County OK's Tax Rate Reviews Election Safety by Sandra Sadek. The Pecos County Commissioners Court adopted its 2020 tax rate and voted to require poll workers, poll watchers, and voters to wear masks when voting during their August 24 meeting. The 2020 total tax rate of 0.7074 was proposed during last week's meeting and is lower than last year's due to an increase in taxable values in the county. The tax rate for the maintenance and operation for general funds is set at 0.6274, and the tax rate for the road and bridge maintenance and operation is set at 0.08. The Midland College Williams Regional Technical Training Center campus tax rate for the maintenance and operation for 2020 was set at 0.0234, which equals the no new revenue tax rate. Face masks and elections. The court also decided to require all poll workers, poll watchers, and voters to wear a face mask when entering any voting place in Pecos County for the 2020 election due to coronavirus, unless deemed otherwise by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. "I want everyone to feel safe to come out and vote," said Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster. "Individuals who refuse to wear a mask or are unable to wear a mask due to medical conditions will be allowed to curbside vote. This decision comes as the number of positive cases in the county reached 200 last weekend and 5 fatalities were confirmed. Counties with more than 20 active cases are currently requiring all residents to wear a mask when out and about. EDC Land Sales. A letter of intent to lease a property located on 766 Northwest Railroad Avenue to the Fort Stockton Economic Development Corporation was unanimously passed by the court. The property would be leased to the EDC for $1 a year. The EDC would then sublease the property to the interested investor. However, the county will still be making money dollar for dollar from the property, according to Pecos County Attorney Frank Lacey. While the property belongs to the county, 4 feet of the building on the property stick out on TxDOT land, which means the investor will need to lease from both the county and the Department of Transportation. The terms of the final contract will be reviewed and approved by the county. The investment is expected to bring 10 new jobs and $400,000 in capital investments, according to EDC Executive Director Remy Ramos. Discussion to give the eastern 128 feet of lots 6 and 8 of Block 5 on St. Gall to the EDC for economic development projects was tabled after concern was brought up that the county would make no money from that piece of land. The development on St. Gall will be part of the EDC, city, and county's attempt to revitalize downtown Fort Stockton. In other action, the court donated 8 computers and screen monitors to the Fort Stockton Police Department, purchased 3 vehicles from Buy Board at the request of the Pecos County Sheriff Cliff Harris. This item was already approved for in the budget, and the vehicles are expected to arrive in January 2021. Passed a resolution adopting the FEMA-approved Pecos County, Texas Multi-Jurisdiction Hazard Mitigation Plan and appointed the county judge as the chief executive officer. This plan allows the county to apply for current and future mitigation grants. Approved appointments for presiding precinct judges and their alternates. Recovering from the crash. The COVID-19 pandemic brought about the end of the oil boom. What's next? By Sandra Sadek. For Baltazar Chavez, opening a food truck with his family was the last thing on his mind, until 3 months ago. The month of March brought the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, and with it, the subsequent end of the Permian Basin's oil boom. Chavez, like hundreds of others who saw their work in the oil and gas industry disappear, has had to find other ways to support himself and his elderly parents. "I lived in Midland for 10 years when all of the COVID started happening and work got slow. I decided to go ahead and move back to Fort Stockton, not only because work was low, but also to assist my elder parents," Chavez said. Chavez ran his own trucking company with his dad, Leeway Services, providing belly dump trailers to oil and gas companies around the area. Now Chavez works two jobs along with helping his mom with a food truck and makes half of what he earned with the trucking company a year. "We had work for the rest of this year, but due to COVID-19, they shut everything down," Chavez said. "Plus, the drop in oil prices, of course, didn't help." The impact of COVID-19 affected the revenue of businesses across all industries. According to data collected by the Office of the Texas Comptroller of Public Accounts, sales taxes for Fort Stockton between February 2020 and June 2020 showed a 12-18% decline compared to the year prior. Remy Ramos, executive director of the Fort Stockton Economic Development Council, said while all industries were affected by the pandemic shutdown, the oil industry will have a harder time picking itself back up to the level it was before March. "When the rest of the world, per se, goes back to work, until people start using gasoline and start traveling and flying airplanes and doing all these things that we used to do that created the demand for gas, is when the oil and gas industry will start to recover," Ramos said. "We're going to be slower to rebound because our jobs not only went away, but the demand for our product also went away." According to the Texas Railroad Commission, oil production in Pecos County dropped from 35 million barrels of oil in 2019 to 15 million barrels of oil in 2020. Gas production in Pecos County dropped from almost 113 million metric cubic feet in 2019 to 45 million metric cubic feet in 2020. Pecos County also saw a surge in unemployment rates in April and May of 2020 compared to those same months last year. According to data collected by the Texas Workforce Commission, Pecos County reported a 10% unemployment rate in April 2020 and a 12.9% unemployment in May 2020 versus a 2.8% to 2.9% unemployment rate in April and May 2019. The unemployment rate for July 2020 was reported at 9.8%. No doubt we got hit real hard because once COVID-19 came, so did the low gas prices. "We got a double whammy here in the oil and gas industry," said Willie Taylor, CEO of the Permian Basin Workforce Board. "When you look at the Permian Basin, the industry represents about 20 to 25% of the total workforce. According to Permian Basin Workforce Board data, April brought the steepest monthly employment decline in mining and logging in the state of Texas. 21,300 jobs were let go. As of June 2020, the industry had a -23.7 annual statewide employment change rate. Even if the oil and gas industry was to pick back up, the uncertainty of the job market has people like Chavez not wanting to risk losing their job again. I'll stay the best that I can out of the oil field because oil field work is not a promise. Pay is good, and what I do right now might not be a lot of income, but it's a more steady income, more job security," Chavez said. With no end in sight of the pandemic and its economic impact on rural regions, local entities are looking for alternate ways to diversify their economy and ensure stable growth in the future. Fort Stockton has begun investing in solar farms as a way to bring in jobs and support various industries across town. With a third solar farm in the works already, Ramos said the investment has allowed struggling places like hotels and motels to sustain themselves through the pandemic. "This is giving some of our citizens ways and opportunities for employment, as well as continuing to maintain our RV parks, hotels, and motels," Ramos said. "These companies bring in anywhere from 800 people during construction." Several other projects are in the works in the Permian Basin, focusing on solar and wind energy, as well as the construction of a second international rail bridge connecting Texas to Mexico, with an opening date set for the first quarter of 2021. The possibilities of importing and exporting goods to Mexico from Fort Stockton is quickly becoming reality, Ramos said. Until then, Chavez said he will continue to take care of his parents and help out with the food truck while keeping a positive outlook on the future. "It's really hard to have to do away, even with your home, so you can save what you have," Chavez said. "We sometimes complain about our lifestyle, our situation, but we always have to think that somebody else has a bigger battle than what we have. How many people would give to see another day? So there's always a positive." City approves Internet Crime Task Force by Sandra Sadek. The City of Fort Stockton has approved a memorandum of understanding between the Fort Stockton Police Department and the Office of the Attorney General of Texas to combat internet crime against minors during their August 25th meeting. The MOU with the Office of the Attorney General of Texas would allow the police department to combine local, county, and state resources to create a task force to fight internet crime against children. The task force will be run by experienced, sworn-in officers and will help the department's Criminal Investigation Division conduct inquiries regarding the topic. I strongly recommend that we approve and create this MOU with the Office of the Attorney General. It will really help us out a lot, said Police Chief Robert Lujan. I personally think it's a very good idea to have this in place to protect our community against child predators. The council also passed a resolution adopting the FEMA-approved Pecos County, Texas Multi-Jurisdiction Hazard Mitigation Plan and appointing the mayor as the chief executive officer and authorized representative. The approved plan allows the city to be eligible to apply for current and future mitigation grants. This is the same resolution approved by Pecos County on August 24. In other action, the council awarded the proposal for a 2-year service agreement for bulk fuel, diesel exhaust fluid, coolant antifreeze, engine oil, and hydraulic oil to WTG Fuels, approved a letter of engagement from Smith & Rivers, PC, to conduct the city's 2020 fiscal year audit, approved a depository agreement between the City of Fort Stockton and Pecos County State Bank to house city funds, agreed to have Construction Product Market make emergency repairs to the paddle wheel aerator unit at the city wastewater plant oxidation ditch, solicited bids for the planning and construction of a new recycling center and to replace the Chamber of Commerce roof, passed an election services contract with the Pecos County Clerk to hold a joint election during early voting by personal appearance beginning October 13, 2020 through October 30, 2020, and on Election Day, November 3rd. Pecos reaches 200 positive case count. County confirms 2 new fatalities. 2 new COVID-19 fatalities were reported for Pecos County this week as the number of positive and active cases across the county continue to increase. The county currently is reporting 29 active cases out of 204 positive cases in county, with 5 total deaths as of August 25th. A total number of 1,721 individuals have been tested and 170 have recovered in county. The newest cases include a 63-year-old female who was hospitalized at University Medical Center Lubbock and was a resident of Focused Care, and a 54-year-old male who was hospitalized at Medical Center Hospital. Pecos County Memorial Hospital CEO Betsy Briscoe gave an update to the Commissioner's Court on Monday about the hospital's testing capabilities. Obituaries in the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, August 20, 2020. Raymond Don Everett. Raymond Ray Don Everett rode off on his last adventure August 13, 2020, surrounded by his wife, daughters, and grandchildren who were the loves of his life. He was born at home, delivered by his grandma, Susie Morris, on February 27, 1950, in Fort Davis, Texas. The third of 7 children belonging to Otto Bud Everett and Pauline Morris Everett. Raised on ranches in West Texas and New Mexico, he left school with a GED at 16 and went to work. On June 14, 1969, he married the love of his life, Dean, and started his family. He dedicated himself to his 4 daughters and his family. Ray is preceded in death by his parents, Bud and Pauline. He is survived by his loving wife, Dean, and his daughters, Samantha Burton and husband Ken, Cynthia Gregory and husband Ben, Stephanie Everett, and Susie Everett. He was pawpaw to 16 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. He is also survived by his brothers, Deb and Bill Everett of Fort Stockton, and his sisters, Kathy Collins, Lacey Everett, and Janie Everett of Fort Stockton, and Pat Crean of Corsicana, Texas. A memorial service honoring Ray will be planned for a later date. Condolences may be sent to the family online at masonfuneralhome@verizon.net. Lindsay Faith Horton. A beloved daughter, granddaughter, sister, niece, cousin, and friend, Lindsay Faith Horton went to be with our Lord in heaven unexpectedly on Monday, August 10, 2020. She was 27. Family and friends gathered to celebrate her life at a memorial service at 10 a.m. on Saturday, August 15, at First Baptist Church in Andrews, with Pastor Brant O'Connor and Major Kevin Banks officiating. Cremation is under the personal care of McNett Funeral Home. Please visit McNettFuneralHome.com for obituary information, service times, and family pictures or videos. Lindsay was born on November 27, 1992, to Jim and Adrienne McGarvey Horton in La Mesa. She grew up in Fort Stockton. She attended the Midland College Nursing Program and graduated as a registered nurse. She was currently attending UT Arlington and would have graduated with her Bachelor of Science in Nursing in December 2020. Lindsay was a nurse at Permian Regional Medical Center. Lindsay is survived by her parents, Jim and Adrienne Horton of Rankin, brother Luke Horton and wife Lauren of Dallas, grandparents Ed and Carla Horton of La Mesa, grandmother Rona McGarvey of Houston, grandmother Bobette Deary and husband Jerome of Booker, Texas, aunts Aaron Stotes and husband Keith of Madison, Wisconsin, Carol Banks and husband Kevin of Tyler, Leah Hoban of Grand Prairie, Texas, uncles Tom McGarvey of Dallas and Neil Horton of Kansas City, Texas. In lieu of flowers, the family would like you to honor her memory by donating to the Lindsay Horton Memorial Nursing Scholarship, No. 5 Abigail Drive, Andrews, Texas, 79714. Oscar Manuel Carrasco. Oscar Manuel Carrasco of Wagon Mound, New Mexico, passed away on August 12, 2020 at the age of 59 in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Oscar was born on May 11, 1961 in Fort Stockton to Ricardo and Alicia Carrasco. Oscar loved to spend time with family and friends. Oscar is survived by his brothers Richard Carrasco Jr., Mary Lou of Odessa, Angel Carrasco, Liz of Midland, and Tony Carrasco of Fort Stockton. Sisters Mary Lou Benavides, Guadalupe, Norma Rojas, Elva Gutierrez, John Robert, all of Fort Stockton, and Olga Carrillo, Gabriel of Midland. Numerous nieces and nephews, and his beloved Sugar. Oscar is preceded in death by his parents and brother Johnny, maternal grandparents Jose and Manuela Ibarra, paternal grandmother Albina Dominguez, paternal grandfather Jose Carrasco, and nephew Guadalupe Benavides Jr. Visitation will be held on Monday, August 17, at Heritage Funeral Home, and services will be held on Tuesday, August 18, at Our Lady of the Guadalupe downtown location in Fort Stockton. Obituaries in the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, August 27, 2020. Johnny M. Blanco. Johnny M. Blanco, age 72, passed away August 24, 2020 in McKamey, Texas. He was born March 30, 1948 in Fort Stockton and was a resident of Fort Stockton. Johnny loved all his Blanco family dearly. He greeted everyone with a smile and a handshake. He was preceded in death by his parents, Frank Blanco Jr. and wife Lupe, and brother James M. Blanco. Survivors include his sister, Mary B. Garcia, and husband Robert, nephews Frankie Garcia, Edna, and Robert Garcia, nieces Sylvia Garcia and Roberta Garcia. Visitation was held Thursday at Heritage Funeral Home, and services were held on Friday at Our Lady of Guadalupe Downtown Campus, Fort Stockton. Remembrances and condolences may be shared with a family at heritagefuneralhomeofthebigbend.com. Juan Lara. Juan Lara passed away Saturday, August 15, 2020, in Odessa at the age of 47 years. He was born on January 13, 1973, to Francisco Lara Ortiz and Teodora Alonso Maciel in Veracruz, Mexico. Juan is survived by his wife, Maria de Jesus Lopez Valdez of Coyanosa, his parents, Francisco Lara Ortiz and Teodora Alonso Maciel, his stepdaughter, Zulema Lopez Orona of Odessa, his stepson, Jesus Antonio Lopez Jurado of Corpus Christi, his step-grandchildren, Estrella Lopez and Fernando Lopez. Funeral service will be at Coyanosa Community Hall in Coyanosa, Texas. Burial will follow at Fort Stockton Catholic Cemetery. Remembrances and condolences may be shared with the family at heritagefuneralhomeofthebigbend.com. Albino R. Martinez, Jr. Albino R. Martinez, Jr., Al of Fort Stockton, passed away on Saturday, August 22, 2020, at the age of 68, in Galveston. He was born on June 21, 1952, in Fort Stockton, to Albino and Manuela Martinez. He is survived by his sisters, Rosa Soto and husband Eduardo of Big Lake, Emilio Martinez Indio of Big Lake, Alfredo Martinez and wife Anita of Fort Stockton, Albert Garcia and husband Angel of Midland, Texas, Josefina Josie Miron and husband Manuel of Odessa. Albino is preceded in death by his parents, Albino Sr. and Manuela Martinez, his wife Carol Cardenas Martinez, his brother Arturo Martinez, and sisters Elvira Sotelo and Carol Agundiz. He has several nephews and nieces that will miss him. Anyone that knew him knows he was awesome. He graduated from Fort Stockton High School, then went into the Marines for 4 years. He married the love of his life, Carol Cardenas Martinez. He had three adopted children, Sean Cardena of Arizona, Chris Power and wife Yvonne of Fort Stockton, and Becky Powers of Boston. A memorial service will be held at a later date.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, August 20th. No Mayor in Grand Falls. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The city of Grand Falls is in search of a new mayor. In the last city council meeting, Mayor Jason Copeland resigned. Mayor Pro Tem Barbara Crawford said Copeland resigned for personal reasons. The council then voted to appoint Enrique Canales to the post, as he was on the ballot for the position on the November 3rd ballot. Prior to Canales being sworn in on Monday morning, he withdrew from consideration because of his workload. According to Crawford, Canales said his workload as an employee of Ward County Precinct 3, a great deal of his time was spent in Monahans. Quote, "We are looking for someone willing to accept the appointment," Crawford said. "Once we find someone, that individual will serve until November and then be reappointed until the May 2021 election. We don't have a large pool to draw from, as a citizen has to be a resident for at least 6 months. But we do have one or two individuals that we will be speaking with, but I cannot release those names at this time." End quote. Crawford was asked if she would consider the post. Quote, "No, as a member of the council, I want to keep my voting rights." End quote. Grand Falls is a community of about 500 people. COVID-19 cases still at 9. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. As of Tuesday afternoon, there were 9 active cases of the COVID-19 virus, according to Ward County Judge Greg Holly. A total of 758 tests have been administered in the county, with a total of 100 cases, 90 recovered, 9 active, and 2 deaths. There are 6 tests pending. Holly said recent questions have come up about being reinfected after recovering from the virus. Quote, "One of the big questions has been the extent to which people who have had the virus might be immune from getting it again. Does having the virus give you lifetime immunity, some limited period of immunity, or no immunity at all? So far, I've seen nothing definitive on this issue. Over the weekend, though, I did hear a rumor that perhaps the CDC is now saying that having the virus gives you 3 months of immunity. So I looked it up on the CDC website, which was updated on Sunday. The website states plainly, at this time, we do not know if someone can be reinfected with COVID-19, Holly said. Across the local area, Ector County has reported 3,889 cases with 62 deaths and 3,082 recovered. Midland has 2,953 with 62 deaths and 1,365 recovered. Andrews County has 346 confirmed cases with 2,207 recovered and 8 deaths. Reeves County has 234 cases with 2 deaths and 193 recovered and 2 deaths. Pecos County has reported 258 cases with 196 recovered and 2 deaths. Crane County has 70 confirmed cases and 10 deaths. Winkler County has 88 confirmed cases with 63 recovered and 1 death. And Rankin County has 66 cases with 52 recovered and 4 deaths. Statewide, there are 127,099 active cases, 542,950 total cases, 405,817 recovered, and 10,034 deaths. Nationally, there are 5.5 million confirmed cases reported with 172,000 deaths. Column charged with child sex abuse involving two victims. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A former Monahans man has been arrested and charged with two charges of aggravated sexual assault of a child, a first-degree felony. Both victims were under 15 at the time of the sexual abuse. The arrest warrant for Jesse Eugene Cullum, age 41, was obtained in May and said the alleged assaults happened approximately 2 to 5 years ago, according to Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana. Quote, two victims made an outcry of sexual abuse by Cullum to officers on April 8th. As a result of the investigation by Lieutenant Jeremy Kynes, an arrest warrant was issued for Cullum, who was believed to be currently living in Oklahoma, he said. There are two counts of aggravated sexual assault filed against Cullum due to ages 13 and 15 of the victims at the time the assaults happened, he added. Information regarding the relationship between Cullum and the victims is not being released at this time. Quote, Cullum was picked up from a jail facility in Arkansas on August 11th, where he was being held on the felony warrants and transferred back to Ward County, Ward County Sheriff Frerin Valle said. Cullum of McAlester, Oklahoma, was booked into Ward County Jail at 2:49 a.m. by Deputy David Rodriguez on Ward County warrants for aggravated sexual assault of a child, a first-degree felony, 2 counts. He is being held on a combined bond of $100,000. If convicted, Cullum could face 5 to 99 years or life in a Texas Department of Criminal Justice facility and or a fine of up to $10,000. Odessa man allegedly shoots himself near Piute. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Danny Mack Zant, age 75, of Odessa, died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound near I-20 westbound 66-mile marker last Wednesday evening. According to Ward County Sheriff Frerin Valle, quote, around 5:30 p.m., Ward County Sheriff's Office dispatch received several calls of a man driving a truck headed west on Interstate 20 around the Monahans area who was swerving all over the road, running other vehicles off the road, and almost rear-ending an 18-wheeler. Ward County Sheriff's Office deputies responded to the area and attempted to get the driver to stop the vehicle. Quote, the driver of the vehicle stopped near mile marker 67, and as deputies approached the suspect vehicle, they saw the driver, who was later identified as Zant through obituary records, holding a pistol in his hand, Valle said. Valle added, quote, as the deputies sought cover, they reported hearing a single gunshot and they were unaware if the suspect shot at them or possibly shot himself, end quote. While awaiting backup, deputies reported observing the suspect moving around inside the vehicle. Quote, for officer safety and to avoid further injury to anyone, deputies did not immediately approach the vehicle, but rather called the Pecos Police Department SWAT team for assistance. They arrived in an armored vehicle in an attempt to make contact with the driver, Valle said. Upon contact, Sant was later discovered deceased, and his body was sent for an autopsy. United States Marshals and Texas Department of Public Safety troopers assisted with the investigation. The motive for the shooting was not known as of press time. MEDC to seek bids for Parkway. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans Economic Development Corporation, or MEDC, Board of Directors, authorized Director Ashley Adalto to obtain bids to finish Monahans Parkway from 8th Street to Business 20 during their regularly scheduled meeting on last Friday. The board decided a few months ago to only finish the road up to 8th Street in an effort to conserve money due to the downturn in the economy. The road completion is estimated to cost a little over $1 million. Quote, "I see no reason why we can't proceed and begin to obtain bids to complete the road. We still have funds available from the county to help offset the cost," Adalto said. The interlocal agreement between the city and the county pledged $1 million from the county to help with construction costs. The current cost of the road construction from 12th Street to 8th Street is $907,000. In other matters, the annual report presented by Adalto was approved. The report detailed MEDC sales tax receipts from 2008 until present, the completion of PJ's Coffee, construction updates on new hotels, 828 Car Wash, the proposed Desert Ridge Addition, Monahans Parkway Road construction, construction update on the 56-unit apartment complex next to the La Quinta, Monahans Fiber Loop update, the new elementary school and roads, completion of the detention pond, and several new housing projects. In other business, the board approved the sale of Lot 3, Block 27, in the East Monahans subdivision to Marlene and Ever Signs. Quote, "This is actually the small easement in the back where their sewer taps in. They wanted to purchase it and use it as the alleyway and move their dumpster there and get it out of the driveway," Adalto said. In the final actionable item on the agenda, accounts payable in the amount of $229,000 was approved. Included in those was a payment to Onyx General Contractors for $197,000 for Parkway Detention Pond and School Access Roads. Maverick Engineering was paid $21,000 for Detention Pond, Platting Desert Ridge, Permitted Roadways and Utilities, and Project Representative. The financial report, reflecting a balance of $3.1 million in available funds and minutes of the July 20th meeting, were approved. Directors present were Larry Bryant, Brian Franks, Richard Irwin, Camilla Blum, and Oscar Fuentes. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on August 20th. Benigno Medina, age 85, passed away on Friday, August 14th. He was born to parents Antonio and Guadalupe Medina in Brownsville, Texas. Benigno was a retired Chief Master Sergeant in the Air Force, honorable discharge after 26 years of service, and retired after 20 years in the Postal Service. He was also a member of St. John's Knights of Columbus and VFW Post 4004. Benigno is preceded in death by his first wife, Felicitas Medina, sisters Mary, Connie, and Vicky, brother Guadalupe, and parents Guadalupe and Antonia. He is survived by his wife Elvira Medina, who he married on May 6, 2003, his children Benny R. and Ann Medina of Montgomery, Alabama, David and Rachel Medina of San Angelo, Texas, Reuben and Stacy Medina of Cedar Hill, Texas, Joseph and Terry Garza of Midland, Jason and Larissa Pittman of Monahans, Corey and Hillary Petrie of Monahans, brother Mike Delatorre of California, 15 grandchildren, 17 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren. Rosary was held on Wednesday, August 19th at Harkey Funeral Home Chapel. Graveside services were held on Thursday at Monahans Memorial Cemetery with Father Alan Alawach officiating. Atella Rios passed on August 17th after a short illness. She was born in Grand Falls on December 19th, 1931, to Francisco and Sofia Rios. Atella was preceded in death by her parents and sisters, Martiana Fuentes, Riomunda Ramirez, Empedia Corrales, brothers Guadalupe Rios and Francisco Rios Jr. Survivors include Sister Santiago Benton of Grand Falls and numerous nieces and nephews, grandnieces and nephews, and great-grandnieces and nephews. Services were held at Harkey Funeral Home on Thursday, August 20th, with Rene Ramon officiating. Burial followed at Tamarisk Cemetery in Grand Falls. Otila attended school in Grand Falls and is a graduate of the class of 1949. She lived most of her life in Grand Falls. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guestbook or leave a personal note for the family. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.